Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 973. They Are All Bound on the Wheel, part 2. Reflections on Charlottesville. This is being recorded on August 29th of the year 2017. In this program, I'm going to present more observations on not only what transpired in Charlottesville, but perhaps even more importantly, the reactions on the part of various interests to what happened in Charlottesville, and the history that preceded that and that set the stage for what happened in Charlottesville. In the For the Record 972, I spoke about the grotesque hypocrisy on the part of the mainstream media, the so-called progressive sector, and the so-called alternative media, who themselves have been almost orgiastic in their fawning over the likes of Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, Glenn Greenwald, Pierre Omidyar, despite the fact that those individuals and institutions and the institutions they represent are at one with the quote alt-right, unquote. Again, a term I hate. And people like David Duke and the neo-Confederate movement, the League of the South, and contemporary outcroppings and political embodiments of the political forces that are memorialized with the statuary such as of the image of Robert E. Lee, that was a focal point for what took place in Charlottesville. And For the Record 971, Nazis in New Orleans, we took a look at some of the past of the alt-right and their role in helping to murder President Kennedy. That is an incident that not only the mainstream media, but to a very large extent, even the so-called progressive media will not talk about. When the Oliver Stone film JFK came out about 16 years ago, a film which is largely accurate from an historical standpoint, and in its essence is fundamentally accurate, not only the mainstream media, but the so-called progressive media were, again, orgiastic in their condemnation of Oliver Stone and the film, and through that, the truth. One of many things that helped to set the stage for what has taken place. I'm going to begin this program by reading again a poem that really sums up my feelings about Charlottesville, and one that I think really embodies the hypocrisy and the failings that not only led to what we saw in Charlottesville, but that embodied the failure of the response to Charlottesville, and beyond that, the better part of 100 years of political failing, going back to the origins of fascism. The title of the program derives in part from a poem, Be Angry at the Sun, by Robinson Jeffers, J-E-F-F-E-R-S, and it reads, "The public men publish falsehoods is nothing new. That America must accept, like the historical republics, corruption and empire has been known for years. Be angry at the sun for setting, if these things anger you. Watch the wheel slope and turn. They are all bound on the wheel. these people, those warriors, this republic, Europe, Asia. Observe them gesticulating. Observe them going down. The gang serves lies. The passionate man plays his part. The cold passion for truth hunts in no pack. You are not Catullus, you know, to lampoon these crude sketches of Caesar. You are far from Dante's feet, but even farther from his dirty political hatreds. Let boys want pleasure, and men struggle for power, and women perhaps for fame, and the servile to serve a leader, and the dupes to be duped. Yours is not theirs. And continuing with what we spoke about in the conclusion to, for the record, 972, and continuing the cold passion for truth and continuing to hunt in no pack, we're going to take a look at the Republican Party. Many Republicans came out and said they were shocked to learn that there was gambling going on in this establishment. And when Donald Trump and David Duke and a great many others said, "Your winnings, sir," they said, "This is terrible, the Republican Party, and America doesn't stand for this." And the hypocrisy of the Republican Party, and beyond that, the silence of our media, the silence of the American political scientific community, the silence of academia, the silence of historians at what has taken place is in and of itself perhaps the most eloquent thing, eloquent in its silence, eloquent in the sounds of silence. By the way, that song, that famous song by Simon and Garfunkel, was written in the aftermath of JFK's assassination and is about the aftermath of JFK's assassination. Silence, like a cancer, grows. Well, it has been. And for the Republican Party to say that, well, America is not about racial hatred or religious bigotry, and we condemn this, and how could Trump have not been more forceful in his condemnation? Well, as I said in the latter part of For the Record 972, that is rather like a syphilitic whore discoursing on the virtues of celibacy while pulling a train. That is as hypocritical as one can get. And we're going to take a look at part of the history of the Republican Party, and in the conclusion to For the Record 971, we took a look at links between Gerhard Fried, the editor of the Deutsche National Zeitung and Solaten Zeitung, an individual whose editorial board on that same newspaper employed former members of the SS, or really, shouldn't say former, members of the SS officials from Goebbels' propaganda ministry, and received funding from the CIA. It was in an interview with the Deutsche National Zeitung and Solaten Zeitung that General Edwin Walker first disclosed to the light of day that it had been Lee Harvey Oswald who tried to shoot him that previous spring. The Warren Report portrays the attempted shooting of Edwin Walker as proof that Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone-nut communist, unquote, was not ideologically motivated when he killed President Kennedy. Of course, Oswald killed nobody. And he was a left cover and at times a right cover intelligence operative, infiltrated first into the Soviet Union, then into leftist groups, and in case the plot began unraveling some of the, quote, alt-right, unquote, groups that we looked at, and for the record, non-71, that to give plausible ideological cover to the assassination. We took a look at Gerhard Fry's and Charles Willoughby's links to the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and people like Yaroslav Stetsko, the founder of the ABN and the head of the Ukraine's Nazi collaborationist government in World War II. The ABN, the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, was founded by Adolf Hitler in 1943 as the Committee of Subjugated Nations, and it was composed of the various Eastern European fascist groups that had allied themselves with the Third Reich and were fundamental to not only the Third Reich's conquests, but in particular their occupation and perpetration of genocide. Germany is not that big a country. And when you occupy an area from France's border with Spain all the way across Europe, up to the Ural Mountains almost, you have got to have surrogates to do your dirty work. And the Hungarian Arrow Cross, the Romanian Iron Guard, the Ukrainian OUNB, the Bulgarian National Front, the Croatian Ustashi, the Slovakian Linka Party, and others were those surrogates, and they were married together and to the Third Reich by the Nazi SS. That organization, in turn, was part and parcel to the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi spy outfit that we have looked at so many times. In an essay that is available, this is from Covert Action Quarterly, number 35, the winter of 1991, there is an article about the Gehlen Organization, The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt, by Carl Oglesby, and it talks about the Gehlen Organization and the fact that General Reinhard Gehlen cleared his actions in having his Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit and much of the surviving SS go for work for the fledgling CIA, then NATO, and finally, while overlapping the first two, the Federal Republic of Germany, where it became the BND, the German Federal Intelligence Service. The Gehlen Org is inextricably linked with the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, and Gehlen was basically clearing what he did with the German high command. From Oglesby's essay, The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt, Gehlen met with Admiral Karl Dönitz, D-O-E-N-I-T-Z, who had been appointed by Hitler as his successor during the last days of the Third Reich. Gehlen and the admiral were now in a U.S. Army VIP prison camp in Wiesbaden. Gehlen sought and received approval from Dönitz, too. In other words, the German chain of command was still in effect and approved of what Gehlen was doing with the Americans. The German chain of command, in addition to Dönitz, also involved General Franz Halder, who had been Gehlen's chief of staff. In a footnote to the article I read, the excerpt I read, as Gehlen was about to leave for the U.S., he left a message for Gerhard Bonn with another of his top aides, Gerhard Wessel. I am to tell you from Gehlen that he has discussed with Hitler's successor, Admiral Karl Dönitz, and Gehlen's superior and chief of staff, General Franz Halder, the question of continuing his work with the Americans. Both were in agreement. And again, that was an indication that when we took in the Gehlen Organization and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, we were basically taking in a functional and very powerful element of the Third Reich's national security establishment. The upshot of that was in the conclusion to Oglesby's article, The key point that comes crashing through the practical and moral confusion about the Galen organization, once one sees that the org was an arm of the Odessa, is that whether it was ethical or not, the U.S. did not pick up a gift horse in Galen at all. It picked up a Trojan horse. The unconditional surrender the Germans made to the Allied command at the Little Red Schoolhouse in Reims, that's in France, was a surrender only of the German armed services. It was not the surrender of the hard SS corps of the Nazi Party. The SS did not surrender unconditionally or otherwise, and thus Nazism itself did not surrender. The SS chose rather to seek other means of continuing the war, while the right wing of the U.S. military establishment, through fears and secret passions and a naivete of its own, chose to facilitate that choice. The history that we have lived through since then stands witness to the consequences. Well, indeed, that includes the history of the GOP. We'll come back to that in just a second.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
We have noted in many places, and I don't have time to go into it, but in For the Record 305, I excerpted key aspects of the landmark text, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning. Galen, in turn, and the ABN, in turn, were answering to Martin Bormann, the Reichsleiter of the Third Reich, and to Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, who held the rank of Minister of the Interior in Exile of Germany. And they put up a Nazi flight capital organization that came to dominate not only corporate Germany, but the transnational cartel system that had birthed the Third Reich and fascism in general in the first place, to a large extent. Ultimately, control of the international cartel system fell to the Bormann Group, in part because of its stock purchases in major U.S. blue-chip corporations and those of other countries' top corporations. And when we talk about the sounds of silence, Paul Manning was one of Edward R. Murrow's boys during World War II. He began his investigation of Martin Bormann and his escape at the behest of Edward R. Murrow. His work was financed by CBS News. They would not go with the story. And they came, Paul Manning came quite close. After contacting the Bormann organization in Latin America, back came the world, back came the word. You are a free world journalist and can write as you think best. We too are interested only in truth. They agreed to my request to bring along a three-man camera crew from CBS News to film my conversations with Martin Bormann, and even approved my wish for at least a personal thumbprint of the former Reichsleiter and party minister, which would be positive proof of his identity. At the organization's request, I sent the background names, photos, and credentials of the particular CBS cameramen, Lawrence Walter Pierce, Richard Henry Perez, and Odin Lester Kitzmiller, an award-winning camera crew which got the exclusive film coverage of the attempted assassination of Governor George Wallace when he was running for president. Ultimately, Heinrich Müller put thumbs down on that. CBS would not go with the story, as we looked at in For the Record 604, and even more importantly in Side 1 of For the Record 152. Some powerful German corporations, including some affiliated with the Thyssen Group, basically put the kibosh on the publication of Paul Manning's book. They forced the cancellation of some book contracts. Finally, Lyle Stewart and his imprint published the book. Lyle Stewart had both of his legs broken the week of publication. Ultimately, Paul Manning continued to pursue the story, and as we looked at in For the Record 125, his son Jerry was murdered, according to Manning's intelligence contacts, in retaliation for his continued pursuit of the story. Martin Borman's FBI file is excerpted on page 205 of the book. Again, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. And in For the Record 305, I have excerpted key aspects of the book. The FBI file revealed that Borman had been banking under his own name from his office in Germany in Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires since 1941, that he held one joint account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, and on August 4th, 5th, and 14th, 1967, had written checks on demand accounts in First National Citibank Overseas Division of New York, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company, all cleared through Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires. One hears a lot about conspiracy theory, and I don't believe in conspiracy theories. This isn't conspiracy theory. These are banking records. I would note that, as we looked at in a number of shows, including For the Record 894, Martin Borman sought Fritz Thyssen, whose economic empire, industrial empire, is a key element of the Borman organization, and whose American contacts were George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush, the great-grandfather and grandfather of W, and the father and grandfather of George H.W. Bush, for whom CIA headquarters is named. And on page 254 of Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile, Borman sought Thyssen as a pipeline to Alan Dulles, and as we looked at in 894, excerpting the very important book, The Devil's Chessboard, the go-to guy for Alan Dulles' CIA incorporating the Galen organization was Prescott Bush, Senator Prescott Bush from Connecticut. The point being that the Republican Party is at one with what I call the Underground Reich and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. One of the key elements cementing the Republican Party to the Underground Reich, the Galen Organization, and the aforementioned anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, formerly the Committee of Subjugated Nations, is the Crusade for Freedom. That was a clandestine operation which had a domestic component and a foreign component as well, as we looked at in For the Record, AFA program number one, also in For the Record 777. The Crusade for Freedom involved the financing of continued combat at a guerrilla warfare level in Eastern Europe by many of the fascist groups that comprised the ABN and ultimately became part of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization in the GOP. The godfather for the Crusade for Freedom was Alan Dulles. The man who oversaw its domestic component was Richard Nixon, the key spokesperson for this organization, essentially not only a double-sided covert operation, one side political in the U.S., the other side military in Europe behind Soviet lines, employing fighters who had fought for the Third Reich, now working for the Office of Policy Coordination, the Galen Org, and the CIA. The person who fronted for that was Ronald Reagan, the fellow who worked out the machinations to bring these people into the U.S. was William Casey, who had been Nixon's SEC director. He was Reagan's campaign manager and then became Reagan's chief of the CIA. The person who turned the Crusade for Freedom Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, the ethnic division of the Republican National Committee, into a permanent branch of the Republican Party was George Herbert Walker Bush when he was chairman of the RNC. We're going to excerpt once again some pieces from The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. John Loftus, a decorated military officer who served as the head of the Justice Department's Office of Special Investigations, which looked into how the Nazis were imported into the U.S. Loftus quit his post when the Reagan administration came in because he saw the very American politicians that he had been investigating coming into power. Of course, the aforementioned George H.W. Bush was Reagan's vice president. From The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, copyright 1994. Frustration over Truman's 1948 election victory over Dewey, which they blamed on the Jewish vote, impelled Dulles and his protege Richard Nixon to work toward the realization of the fascist freedom fighter presence in the Republican Party's ethnic outreach organization. As a young congressman, Nixon had been Alan Dulles' confidant. They both blamed Governor Dewey's razor-thin loss to Truman in the 1948 presidential election on the Jewish vote. When he became Eisenhower's vice president in 1952, Nixon was determined to build his own ethnic base. Vice President Nixon's secret political war of Nazis against Jews in American politics was never investigated at the time. The foreign language speaking Croatians and other fascist emigre groups had a ready-made network for contacting and mobilizing the Eastern European ethnic bloc. There is a very high correlation between CIA domestic subsidies to fascist freedom fighters during the 1950s and the leadership of the Republican Party's ethnic campaign groups. The motive for the under-the-table financing was clear. Nixon used Nazis to offset the Jewish vote for the Democrats. In 1952, Nixon had formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee, displaced fascists, hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis, even members of the SS. They flooded into the country, and Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program. As vice president, he even received Eastern European fascists in the White House. And again, the key political leadership of the Crusade for Freedom and the formation of a Republican ethnic division, basically an outpost of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations within the Republican Party, again from the Loftus and Ahrens text. As a young movie actor in the early 1950s, Reagan was employed as the public spokesperson for an Office of Policy Coordination front named the Crusade for Freedom. Reagan may not have known it, but 99% of the Crusade's funds came from clandestine accounts, which were then laundered through the Crusade to various organizations, such as Radio Liberty, which employed Dulles' fascists. Bill Casey, who later became CIA director under Ronald Reagan, also worked in Germany after World War II on Dulles' Nazi Freedom Fighters program. When he returned to New York, Casey headed up another OPC front, the International Rescue Committee, which sponsored the immigration of these fascists to the United States. Casey's committee replaced the International Red Cross as the sponsor for Dulles' recruits. And of the person who installed the Republican Ethnic Outreach Group as a permanent branch of the Republican Party, again from The Secret War Against the Jews, it was Bush who fulfilled Nixon's promise to make the ethnic emigre a permanent part of Republican politics. In 1972, Nixon's State Department spokesman confirmed to his Australian counterpart that the ethnic groups were very useful to get out the vote in several key states. Bush's tenure as head of the Republican National Committee exactly coincided with Laszlo Pastor's 1972 drive to transform the Heritage Groups Council into the party's official ethnic arm. The groups Pastor chose as Bush's campaign allies were the emigre fascists whom Dulles had brought to the United States. Laszlo Pastor was Hungarian. He was the liaison between the Hungarian Arrow Cross, the Hungarian fascist group allied with the Nazis, and Adolf Hitler personally. He then came to the U.S. where he served as the liaison between the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, basically an outpost of the ABN, and the Republican Party. When Reagan came into office, the lists from which all of his appointments were made were drawn up by a woman named Helena von Dahn, who was a political protege of Otto von Bolsring, who was another of the Nazis brought into the U.S. As part of this operation. And von Bolsring had been Adolf Eichmann's superior in the liquidation of the Jews. I helped to break the story of Otto von Bolsring back in, I played a very tiny role in helping to break the Otto von Bolsring story back in 1981.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Ronald Reagan's organization, his administration, I should say, incorporated the ABN people, the very people we saw networking with Charles Willoughby, with Gerhard Fry, and the people who killed JFK to a tremendous extent. Indeed, the assassination of Stefan Bandera, who was the head of the OUNB, appears to have not been done by the KGB, as we looked at in For the Record 876 and other shows, but appears to have been part of an operation to set up Lee Harvey Oswald as a Soviet assassin. Bogdan Stashinsky, the ostensible assassin or the ostensible KGB assassin of Stefan Bandera, who was killed on October 15th of 1959, the same day that Lee Harvey Oswald, quote, defected, unquote, to the Soviet Union, still had, at the time of his trial in 1961, the broken shaft to the key to Stefan Bandera's apartment, and the other half of the key was still in the lock to Bandera's apartment, this 2 years after the assassination. That simply does not seem credible. The attorney for Bandera's widow was Charles Kersten, K-E-R-S-T-E-N, a Republican congressman from Illinois, who, along with others from what was known then as the WACCFL, the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, it became the WACL a few years later, incorporating the ABN. They floated the story that, in fact, Oswald had been part of the same KGB assassination program that killed Bandera. Another person who helped to develop gravitas for that was a guy named Lev Dobryansky, who went on to become the head of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, the top OUNB front organization in the U.S. He then became Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas. It was through the Bahamas Al-Taqwa branch that the Afghan Mujahideen were funded, and later Al-Qaeda as well, through the Bank Al-Taqwa, headed up by a former Nazi intelligence operative named Youssef Naba. A profound influence in that by François Genoux, the heir to the political Last Will and Testament and collected literary works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. Ultimately, Reagan chose as his deputy director of public liaison a woman named Ekaterina Chumachenko, who was a key UCCA, Ukrainian Congress Committee of America operative, under the Free Congress Foundation, as we looked at in AFA program number 37, and actually in number 36 and number 37, and as we looked at in For the Record 778. Laszlo Pastor, again, who had served as liaison between the Arrow Cross and Hitler, then as liaison between the ABN and the Republican Party, was the head of the Liberation Branch of the Free Congress Foundation, which then projected these Eastern European fascists back into the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. One of the key people to note was a guy named Roman Zvorich. Roman Zvorich was Yaroslav Stetsko's personal secretary in the early 1980s. He returned to the Ukraine, and when the Orange Revolution, unquote, brought Viktor Yushchenko to power, Viktor Yushchenko's wife and the first lady of the Ukraine, or the first lady of the Ukraine, was the aforementioned Ekaterina Chumachenko, who had been the deputy director of public liaison under Ronald Reagan, the fellow who assumed position of justice minister in the Ukraine, was Roman Zvorich. That's equivalent of attorney general. He held the same post under both Tymoshenko governments, Yulia Tymoshenko. Then Roman Zvorich became an advisor to Petro Poroshenko when some of the OUNB successor organizations, such as Svoboda and Pravi Sector or Right Sector, came to power through the Maidan coup. I would note that in many ways the Roman Zvorich became an advisor to Petro Poroshenko, I should say. He then became the spokesperson for the Azov Battalion. That is one of the point elements of the Ukrainian military. They receive financing and training from the Pentagon. They fly the swastika and the SS rune on their combat helmets. The chief spokesperson for the Azov Battalion is Roman Zvorich, the personal secretary to Yaroslav Stetsko in the early 1980s. In many ways, the Yushchenko government was sort of like Maidan 1 or Maidan 1. Valentin Nalavichenko, the OUNB follower who became head of the intelligence service under Yushchenko, assumed the same role for a time under Poroshenko. A guy named Volodymyr Vyatrovich became the head of the Ukrainian intelligence services archives, and basically began turning Ukrainian World War II history on its head. The 14th Waffen-SS or Galician Division were portrayed as heroes who saved Jews from the Holocaust. Nothing could be further from the truth. And Stefan Bandera, the head of the OUNB, and a guy named Roman Shukevich, the head of the UPA, the military branch of the OUNB, a fellow who held the rank of Hauptmann or captain in the Ukrainian Schutzmannschaft, the auxiliary police. It was Roman Shukevich who headed up the Nightingale Group, or the Nachtigall Group. That was the Einsatzgruppe and Nachtigall liquidated the Jewish population of Lvov in Ukraine on June 30th, 1941. He was commemorated as a hero of the Ukraine by Yushchenko, as was Stefan Bandera. And now the city of Lvov has a Shukevich Fest on June 30th, which celebrates Roman Shukevich under Volodymyr Vyatrovich and his Institute for National Memory. The history of World War II under Hitler has been stood on its head. Organizations like the 14th Waffen-SS Division, the 36th Waffen-SS Panzer Grenadier Brigade, and other smaller formations are portrayed as heroes. It is now illegal in Ukraine to tell the truth. If you say anything criticizing the OUNB or the UPA, both of which were Third Reich collaborationist organizations, that is a crime. And in this country, the same Republican politicians, the same mainstream politicians, and for the most part, the so-called alternative media and the so-called progressive sector will not talk about that. It is as though if one criticized Robert E. Lee of the Confederacy, one would be arrested. It is illegal to tell the truth about what happened in World War II in Ukraine, and our media are playing along with it. And to see the Republican Party, which, again, is inextricably linked with the ABN, with the Galen Organization, through the Crusade for Freedom, people like Richard Nixon, Alan Dulles, Ronald Reagan, William Casey, George H.W. Bush, for these people to pose as righteously indignant critics of Donald Trump, who stinks, by the way. I have no use for Donald Trump, and was warning about him during the campaign. 48% of the eligible voters didn't vote, and a lot of them voted for Jill Stein and others. Well, again, listening to them talk about what happened in Charlottesville and condemn racism or anti-Semitism, it is like a syphilitic whore discoursing on the virtues of celibacy while pulling a train. It is grotesque. That public men publish falsehoods is nothing new. That America must accept, like the historical republics, corruption and empire has been known for years. Be angry at the sun for setting if these things anger you. Watch the wheel slope and turn. They are all bound on the wheel, these people, those warriors, this republic, Europe, Asia. Observe them gesticulating. Observe them going down. The gang serves lies. The passionate man plays his part. The cold passion for truth hunts in no pack.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
As I've noted as well, the lone nut, not lone nut, but the lone wolf leaderless resistance strategy for having individual killers act out Nazi and white supremacist doctrine, as Mr. Fields did when he drove a car into the Charlottesville counter-demonstrators. The groundwork for that, running legal interference for that, was none other than Glenn Greenwald. And Greenwald's journalistic financial angel, Pierre Omidyar, helped to finance the OUNB coup in Ukraine. He also financed the rise of Narendra Modi and his Hindutva fascism in India as well. Time permitting, we will return to that. We have seen a number of outcroppings of lone wolf, leaderless resistance violence, and I want to note something. I noted in For the Record 953 and came back to it in For the Record 971, the Nazis in New Orleans, sort of a prequel to the They Are All Bound on the Wheel mini-series that we are doing. In Portland, Oregon, shortly after, well, not shortly after the election, but in 2017, there was an anti-white supremacist demonstration, and a fellow named Jeremy Christian stabbed a couple, and I shouldn't say a demonstration, but a fellow named Jeremy Christian fatally stabbed two people who were attempting to stop him from harassing a Muslim woman. Interesting bit about Jeremy Christian. Now, I spoke about the socialist Workers' Party in, for the record, 953. That was the ideological petri dish in which Bernie Sanders was cultured, also the ideological petri dish in which Lyndon LaRouche was cultured, and it was used as a vehicle for painting red a number of different fascists and spooks, including Roy Frankhauser, the Pennsylvania Klan leader who himself worked for CIA, among other intelligence services, as we looked at in AFA 13. And he discussed not only his own infiltration of the SWP, but that of the Paines, two of Oswald's, quote, liberal, unquote, babysitters, who themselves had profound links to the intelligence community and people from Project Paperclip. Jeremy Christian, again, the fellow who stabbed two people to death who were attempting to interdict his harassment of a Muslim woman, has an interesting background. From the Oregon Live blog, that is the blog of the Portland Oregonian, from June 2nd of 2017, article by Lizzie Acker, A-C-K-E-R, who is Jeremy Christian? Facebook shows a man with nebulous political affiliations who hated Hillary Clinton and circumcision. And it talks about Mr. Burley, who is authoring a forthcoming book about American fascism. Burley believes that Christian's journey as played out on Facebook from Bernie Sanders and Standing Rock to Donald Trump and white nationalism and ultimately violence is not uncommon. One will find a certain amount of ideological drift, particularly for alienated young people who are, quote, against the establishment. That may have been the case with Jeremy Christian. He does appear, though, to have harbored Nazi/white supremacist views for quite some time. What I wonder is this: to what extent has the Sanders campaign been used by some of the same types of, quote, alt-right, unquote, elements who used the Socialist Workers' Party as a vehicle for basically painting themselves red so that the political disruption and or the violence that they perpetrated, or in the case of the intelligence community, the violence perpetrated or allegedly perpetrated by some of the spooks infiltrated into SWP, such as Lee Harvey Oswald, could be tarred, basically could be blamed on the, quote, communists, unquote. Interesting aspect of Mr. James T. Hodgkinson. He was the fellow who gunned down a bunch of members of congressmen at a baseball game that they staged, including Steve Scalise, who, by the way, is someone of the David Duke mold. From CNN of June 15th of 2017, article by Joseph Palieri, P-A-G-L-I-E-R-Y. Suspect in Scalise shooting was Bernie Sanders supporter and strongly anti-Trump. James T. Hodgkinson, the man identified as shooting a Republican member of Congress and four others on Wednesday morning, was a small business owner in Illinois who defined himself publicly by his firm support of Bernie Sanders' progressive politics and his hatred of conservatives and President Donald Trump. I had the same question about Hodgkinson as about Jeremy Christian. Might he had actually been a Nazi white supremacist type infiltrated into the Sanders campaign, much the way the intel community and the fascist and racist groups in the U.S. used the SWP. That, again, was the ideological petri dish in which Bernie Sanders and Lyndon LaRouche were cultured. And one wonders, perhaps, if we will be seeing Bernie Sanders people playing out in this regard. Certainly, the Republicans made tremendous political hay from the shooting of Scalise, saying, you see, this is the left terrorizing us, and so forth. To what extent is the Bernie Sanders campaign at one level being used like the Socialist Workers' Party, which was so infiltrated, as I have noted, by spooks and by undercover fascists and Nazis, that if you stood in the meeting of the SWP and threw a rock in the air, the chances are 9 out of 10 that rock would have landed on either a spook, a Nazi, or someone who was both. Bernie Sanders was a presidential elector for the Socialist Workers' Party in 1980. He was never, in my opinion, meant to get the Democratic nomination, but alienate enough people on the left from Hillary Clinton to help elect Donald Trump. In this regard, serving as the spoiler long advocated by Roger Stone, the Trump dirty tricks, or the Trump campaign manager, and de facto dirty tricks man after that. I've never seen anything concrete linking Stone to Sanders, although Bernie Sanders' campaign was financed, as a matter of public record, through Karl Rove's American Crossroads Super PAC. It is a pretty good bet that many of those, if not almost all of those, small anonymous donations were made by bots. If you can get someone's identity, then you can use bots, which are a major factor on the Internet. When one of these mega pop stars announces a concert tour, a lot of the tickets are actually bought by bots in advance, working for one element or another. To do that, you have to have a person's identity, and the Republican Deep Root database had the personal information of 200 million American voters. And I think it is a reasonable thing to conclude that Bernie Sanders, whatever his own personal motivations, I don't believe they were sinister. I do think the man is incredibly immature, very self-righteous, and very stupid, frankly. I don't think he is sinister in intent. But when you have Karl Rove financing something like the Sanders campaign, you want to be answering yourselves questions. And just imagine what the scouring right-wing media machine in this country would have done with this. It was from Michelle Goldberg from Slate Magazine, of February 24th of 2016, Bernie Sanders' radical past. There's more. In 1980, Sanders served as an elector for the Socialist Workers' Party, which was founded on the principles of Leon Trotsky. According to the New York Times, that party called for abolishing the military budget. It also called for solidarity, unquote, with the revolutionary regimes in Iran, Nicaragua, Grenada, and Cuba, this in the middle of the Iranian hostage crisis. There is no way Sanders would have possibly become president if he had gotten the Democratic nomination. If, for the sake of argument, he did, he would have been killed. That man would have set a new world's indoor record for death. And in the book, The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Rees, published in 1944, it talks about how the Nazis had long seen Trotskyites as a vehicle for political control by infiltration and subversion. Hitler commented of Trotsky, "You should read his books," he barked. "We can learn a lot from him." And skipping down. The development of the Trotsky movement may have given Himmler more than one idea for the underground movement he is now working out. In the description for this program, I have included a document from March 15th of 1944, at right about that same time, talking about how German intelligence assets in the U.S. could make a great deal of political hay by fanning the U.S. fear of Bolshevism. Ultimately, that morphed into the Galen Organization, the ABN, and the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, at one with a Third Reich gone underground. I noted in For the Record 941 and 942, and also in 945, that Tulsi Gabbard, who was Bernie Sanders' potential or projected vice presidential selection and who placed his name in nomination in the Republican convention, was not only a big promoter of Narendra Modi, but was networking with the RSS in India. The RSS is the Hindu Nationalist / Fascist, the Hindutva, H-I-N-D-U-T-V-A, fascist organization that murdered Mahatma Gandhi. And the BJP of Narendra Modi is a political cat's paw for that organization. Tulsi Gabbard had much to do with the arranging of the American tour by Narendra Modi, and again was networking with the RSS. The ascent of Narendra Modi in India and his RSS was financed in part by Pierre Omidyar, who also helped to finance the OUNB fascist ascent in Ukraine. When I first came across Tulsi Gabbard, I was initially impressed by her. She was opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood and opposed to U.S. financing of jihadists. Plus, she's photogenic and had a veteran's background, which would have made her valuable political capital. Then I found out more about her. It turns out her opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood and the jihadists was part of a broader bigotry against Muslims, although I'm sure she would officially deny that. But when you're networking not only with Narendra Modi, but the RSS and their vicious, lethal anti-Muslim bigotry, it is hard to deny that. Furthermore, Tulsi Gabbard also co-sponsored a piece of legislation which would have branded anyone opposed to the Ukraine's entry into the EU as a terrorist. That is a pretty interesting definition of a terrorist. And as we looked at in For the Record 941 and 942, Gabbard is associated with an offshoot of the fascist mind control cult, the Hare Krishna movement. I will go into the Hare Krishna movement at some point in the future. Although Gabbard has been portrayed as the first Hindu member of Congress, that is actually misleading. The Hare Krishnas view other Hindus as, well, they view them with great disdain. And Guru Prabhupada, the head of that organization, expressed views very sympathetic to Hitler, anti-Semitic, virulently anti-black, anti-Native American, and generally very sympathetic to Hitler, probably embodying some of the occult Nazi or esoteric Nazi views of the SS. And Tulsi Gabbard is not only a member of that organization, the Hare Krishna group, but her husband is a member of that offshoot. Her in-laws are members of that offshoot. So are her parents, and so is her congressional staff. And again, this is someone who co-sponsored a piece of legislation that would have branded anyone opposed to Ukraine's entry into the EU as a terrorist, unquote. An interesting person, too, present at Charlottesville was a Harvard professor and Bernie Sanders supporter named Cornel West. Cornel West got on the Democratic Party's platform committee and basically functioned like an agent provocateur. It would be interesting to know if, in fact, he is in the pay of intelligence services or the FBI or someone. If not, he is missing a paycheck. I heard an interview with him after he walked out basically and decried the Democratic Party platform, saying that, well, we didn't get everything we want. Well, you never do. This is real life. You never get everything you want, and you sure as bloody hell don't get it in politics. He then said, well, we have only one choice to vote, and that is to vote for Jill Stein and the Green Party. And Cornel West, sure enough, he was present at Charlottesville. And for someone like that, someone who said, well, we have no choice but to vote for Jill Stein, to be decrying Charlottesville, well, that is its own reward. I know that Bernie Sanders demonstrated a great racial insensitivity when Hillary Clinton won a major day of primaries in the South, primarily by garnering the African-American vote. Sanders responded to that with one of his idiotic one-liners, and I've seen him so many times just fail when it came to political formulation. He said, well, those are very conservative states, weren't they? Well, the reason Hillary Clinton won was because of African Americans in those states who did not want to see the likes of Donald Trump and the neo-Confederate movement and white supremacists or, quote, alt-right coming to power. And again, I've seen Sanders demonstrate so much of that kind of just gross political ignorance, that perhaps for some other time. But I think it is fair to ask to what extent Sanders was actually probably against his knowledge, or without his knowledge, being used as a vehicle for putting these people in power. Certainly the SWP was. Certainly Karl Rove was financing his campaign. I doubt Bernie was aware of that either. That is a matter of public record. We went into that in For the Record 953. So again, they are all bound on the wheel. These people, those warriors, this republic, Europe, Asia, observe them gesticulating. Observe them going down. The gang serves lies. The passionate man plays his part. The cold passion for truth hunts in no pack. And skipping down, let boys want pleasure and men struggle for power and women perhaps for fame and the servile to serve a leader and the dupes to be duped. Yours is not theirs. Indeed. This concludes For the Record 973. They are all bound on the wheel, part two, Reflections on Charlottesville. This is being recorded on August 29th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.